he, is obscured more than it is clarified by his own tendentious account in Mein Kampf. As usual, this is characterized less by pure invention than by selective memory and distortion of facts. And, as throughout his book, Hitler's version of events is aimed, more than all else, at elevating his own role as it denigrates, plays down, or simply ignores that of all others involved. It amounts, as always in Hitler's own account, to the story of a political genius going his way in the face of adversity, a heroic triumph of the will. The story was the core of the party legend, which in later years Hitler never tired of retelling at inordinate length as the preface to his major speeches. It was that of the political genius who joined a tiny body with grandiose ideas, but no hope of realizing them, raising it single-handedly to a force of the first magnitude which would come to rescue Germany from its plight. Hitler wrote contemptuously of the organization he had joined. The state of the party was depressing in the extreme. The committee constituted practically the whole membership. Though it attacked parliamentary rule, its own matters were decided, after interminable argument, by majority vote. It met in the dingy back rooms of Munich pubs. It had no permanent headquarters. In fact, it had no membership forms, no printed matter, not even a rubber stamp. Invitations to party meetings were handwritten or produced on a typewriter. The same few people turned up. Eventually, a move to mimeographed notices brought a modest rise in numbers attending, and funds were raised to allow a newspaper advertisement in the Münchner Beobachter for a meeting on the 16th of October 1919, which attracted 111 people to the Hofbraukeller, the large drinking saloon attached to one of Munich's big breweries, situated in Wienerstrasse to the east of the city centre, and not to be confused with the better-known Hofbrauhaus, located in the city centre itself. The main speaker was a Munich professor, but Hitler, according to his own account, then spoke for the first time in public, apart from to captive audiences in the Lechfeld camp, for half an hour instead of his scheduled 20 minutes. He electrified his audience and prompted a collection of 300 marks for the party coffers. He brought some of his army contacts into the movement, breathing much-needed new life into it. The party leaders, Harrer and Drexler, were, in his view, uninspiring. They were neither good speakers, nor had they served in the war. Hitler and the party leadership were at odds about future strategy. On the basis of his initial success, Hitler insisted on more frequent and larger meetings. He got his way, and these took place in the Ebelbraukeller and the Gasthaus zum Deutschen Reich on Dachauer Straße near the barracks area, with Hitler speaking to bigger audiences and with great success. By the seventh meeting a few weeks later, the attendance had swollen to over 400 people. Hitler's star was now in the ascendant within the party. Early in 1920, his account went on, he urged the staging of the first great mass meeting. Again, there were major differences of opinion within the party leadership, doubters arguing that it was premature and would be a disastrous failure. The cautious Harrer, the party's first chairman, resigned because of his disagreement with Hitler and was replaced by Drexler. Again, Hitler prevailed. The mass meeting was organized for the 24th of February 1920 in the Festsaal of the Hofbrauhaus in the center of Munich. The big noisy hall on the first floor, above the even rougher and rowdier Schwemme down below, had, like all the city's numerous big drinking establishments, rows of tables, stacked with the stone beer mugs and benches, groaning under the weight of thick-set men in Bavarian short leather trousers, while hefty waitresses bustled between the tables, delivering foaming liters of beer. When it was not hired out, as it frequently was for large political meetings, the beer-swilling crowds would sway merrily to drinking songs played by a Bavarian brass band. At political meetings, heavy drinking, prompting verbal interjections and sometimes brawls, was commonplace. Moving to such a venue, a far bigger hall than the infant party had so far used, was risky, courting the embarrassment of a small turnout. A good deal of effort was put into designing striking red posters and leaflets advertising the meeting. The party's program, to be announced at the meeting, was also printed and distributed. The publicity worked. The huge hall was packed, when Hitler arrived at 7:15 that evening. Still, according to his own account, after a first speaker, whose name he does not mention, had spoken, Hitler, chairing the meeting in the absence of Drexler, who had apparently suffered some sort of nervous collapse, took the floor. Clashes between his supporters and those trying to heckle the speaker took place, but Hitler continued speaking, to mounting applause, and expounded the program, swaying his audience to rapturous and unanimous acclamation of its 25 points. Finally, declares Hitler, in his Mein Kampf version, there stood before me a hall full of people united by a new conviction, a new faith, a new will. The German hero was setting out on his quest. A fire was kindled from whose flame one day the sword must come, which would regain freedom for the Germanic Siegfried and life for the German nation. Thus, slowly the hall emptied. The movement took its course. The story has been aptly described as a heroic legend in half-naturalistic style, young Siegfried warbling his wood notes wild in Munich beer halls. The legend was framed to portray the beginnings of the Führer figure, Germany's coming great leader and savior, as it had emerged by the writing of the first volume of Mein Kampf in 1924. Towering over the weak and vacillating early leaders of the party, certain of himself and of the coming to fruition of his mighty vision, proven successful in his methods, his greatness, so his account was designed to illustrate, was apparent even in these first months after joining the movement. There could be no doubt about his claim to supremacy in the Volkisch movement against all pretenders. After dealing with subsequent successes in building up the party's following, Hitler returned to the early party history in a later passage in Mein Kampf, when, surprisingly briefly and remarkably vaguely, he described his takeover of the party leadership in mid-1921. His terse summary simply indicates that after intrigues against him and the attempt of a group of Volkisch lunatics supported by the party chairman, Drexler, to obtain the leadership of the party had collapsed, a general membership meeting unanimously gave him leadership over the whole movement. His reorganization of the movement on the 1st of August 1921 swept away the old, ineffectual, quasi-parliamentary way of running party matters by committee and internal democracy, and substituted for it the leadership principle as the organizational basis of the party. His own absolute supremacy was thereby assured. Here, it seems, embodied in the description in Mein Kampf is the realization of Hitler's ambition for dictatorial power in the movement, subsequently in the German state, which could be witnessed in his early conflicts with Harre and Drexler, and his rejection of the initial inner-party democratic style. The weakness of lesser mortals, their inability to see the light, the certainty with which he went his own way, and the need to follow a supreme leader who alone could ensure ultimate triumph, these, from the outset, are the dominant themes. The beginning of his claim to leadership can thus be located in the earliest phase of his activity within the party. In turn, this suggests that the self-awareness of political genius was present from the beginning. Little wonder that, on the basis of this story, the enigma of Hitler is profound. The nobody of Vienna, the corporal who is not even promoted to sergeant, now appears with a full-blown political philosophy, a strategy for success, and a burning will to lead his party and sees himself as Germany's coming great leader. However puzzling and extraordinary, the underlying thrust of Hitler's self-depiction has found a surprising degree of acceptance. But, though not inaccurate in all respects, it requires substantial modification and qualification. 3. The break with Karl Harre soon came. It was not, however, an early indicator of Hitler's relentless striving for dictatorial power in the movement. Nor was it simply a matter of whether the party should be a mass movement or a type of closed Volkisch debating society. A number of Volkisch organizations at the time faced the same problem and attempted to combine an appeal to a mass audience with regular meetings of an exclusive inner circle. Harre tended strongly towards the latter, represented by the workers' circle, which he himself controlled, in contrast to the party's working committee, where he was simply an ordinary member. But Harrer found himself increasingly isolated. Drexler was as keen as Hitler to take the party's message to the masses. He later claimed that he, and not Hitler, had proposed announcing the party's program at a mass meeting in the Hofbrauhausfestsaal, and that Hitler had initially been skeptical about the prospects of filling the hall. As long as Harrer directed the party through his control of the workers' circle, the question of the more viable propaganda strategy would remain unresolved. It was necessary, therefore, to enhance the role of the committee, which Drexler and Hitler did in draft regulations that they drew up in December, giving it complete authority and ruling out any superior or side government, whether as a circle or lodge. The draft regulations, bearing Hitler's clear imprint, determined that the committee's members and its chairman should be elected in an open meeting. Their unity, it went on, would be ensured through strict adherence to the programme of the party, which Hitler and Drexler were already preparing. The new regulations were plainly directed against Harrer, but they were not devised as a stepping stone on the way to Hitler's supreme power in the party. Evidently, he had no notion of dictatorial party rule at the time. He was ready to accept the corporate leadership of an elected committee. Decisions to stage mass meetings in the next months were, it seems, those of the committee as a whole, approved by a majority of its members, not Hitler's alone, though once Harrer had departed, and in view of Hitler's increasing success in drawing the crowds to listen to his speeches, it is hard to believe that there was any dissension. Harrer alone, it appears, opposed the staging of an ambitious mass meeting in early 1920, and accepted the consequences of his defeat by resigning. Personal animosity also played a role. Harrer, remarkably, thought little of Hitler as a speaker. Hitler was in turn contemptuous of Harrer. The party's first mass meeting was initially planned to take place in the Bürgerbraukeller, another large beer hall on Rosenheimer Straße, just over the river Isar, about half a mile southeast of the city centre, in January 1920, but had to be postponed because of a general ban on public meetings at the time. It was rescheduled for the Hofbrauhaus on the 24th of February. The fear that the meeting would be broken up through planned disturbances by political opponents anxious to disrupt the first big meeting of a party calling itself a workers' party was probably exaggerated at this early stage in the party's development. Large anti-Semitic meetings were nothing new in Munich at the time. Disturbances had to be reckoned with. A high point of the anti-Semitic wave of agitation that had begun in Munich in summer 1919 had already taken place. A huge meeting of the Schutz- und Trutzbund on the 7th of January 1920, attended by 7,000 people, had provoked scenes of uproar. Corporal Hitler, who made a brief contribution to the discussion, cannot fail to have been impressed by the resonance of anti-Semitic agitation, or by the mark on public opinion in Munich made by such a piece of political theatre. The main worry of Hitler, as of Drexler, was not that there would be disruption, but that the attendance would be embarrassingly small. This was why, since Drexler recognised that neither he nor Hitler had any public profile, he approached Dr. Johannes Dingfelder, not even a party member, but well known in Munich folkish circles, to deliver the main speech on what we are needing, was uns not tut. Hitler's name was not even mentioned in any of the publicity, nor was there any hint that the party's program would be proclaimed at the meeting. The 25 points of this program, which would in the course of time be declared unalterable and be in practice largely ignored, had been worked out and drafted over the previous weeks by Drexler and Hitler. Discussion was already underway in mid-November 1919. Drexler had a draft ready a month later and produced a further draft by the 9th of February before the final version was produced in time for the Hofbrauhaus meeting. The content had much in common with the programme of the DSP. Its points, among them demands for a greater Germany, land and colonies, discrimination against Jews and denial of citizenship to them, breaking interest slavery, confiscation of war profits, land reform, protection of the middle class, persecution of profiteers, and tight regulation of the press, contained little or nothing that was original or novel on the folkish right. Religious neutrality was included in the attempt to avoid alienating a large church-going population in Bavaria. Common good before individual good was an unobjectionable banality. The demand for a strong central power in the Reich and the unconditional authority of a central parliament, though clearly implying authoritarian, not pluralistic, government, gives no indication that Hitler envisaged himself at this stage as the head of a personalized regime. There are some striking omissions. Neither Marxism nor Bolshevism is mentioned. The entire question of agriculture is passed over, apart from the brief reference to land reform. The authorship of the program cannot fully be clarified. Probably the individual points derived from several sources among the party's leading figures. The attack on interest slavery obviously drew on Gottfried Feder's pet theme. Profit sharing was a favorite idea of Drexler. The forceful style, in comparison with the more wordy DSP program, sounds like Hitler's. As he later asserted, he certainly worked on it. But probably the main author was Drexler himself. Certainly Drexler himself claimed this in the private letter he wrote to Hitler, though did not send, in January 1940. In this letter he stated that, following all the basic points already written down by me, Adolf Hitler composed, with me, and with no one else, the 25 Theses of National Socialism, in long nights in the workers' canteen, at Burghausener Strasse 6. Despite worries about the attendance at the party's first big meeting, some 2,000 people, perhaps a fifth of them socialist opponents, were crammed into the Festsaal of the Hofbrauhaus on the 24th of February, when Hitler, as chairman, opened the meeting. Dingfelder's speech was unremarkable. Certainly it was un-Hitler-like in style and tone. The word Jew was never mentioned. He blamed Germany's fate on the decline of morality and religion and the rise of selfish material values. His recipe for recovery was order, work, and dutiful sacrifice for the salvation of the fatherland. The speech was well received and uninterrupted. The atmosphere suddenly livened when Hitler came to speak. His tone was harsher, more aggressive, less academic than Dingfelder's. The language he used was expressive, direct, coarse, earthy, that used and understood by most of his audience. His sentences short and punchy. He heaped insults on target figures like the leading centre-party politician and Reich Finance Minister Matthias Erzberger, who had signed the armistice in 1918 and strongly advocated acceptance of the detested Versailles Treaty the following summer. Or the Munich capitalist Isidor Bach, sure of the enthusiastic applause of his audience. Verbal assaults on the Jews brought new cheers from the audience, while shrill attacks on profiteers produced cries of "Flog them! Hang them!" When he came to read out the party program, there was much applause for the individual points, but there were interruptions too from left-wing opponents who had already been getting restless, and the police reporter of the meeting spoke of scenes of great tumult so that I often thought it would come to brawling at any minute. Hitler announced, to storms of applause, what would remain the party's slogan. Our motto is only struggle. We will go our way, unshakably, to our goal. The end of Hitler's speech, in which he read out a protest at an alleged decision to provide 40,000 hundredweight of flour for the Jewish community, again erupted into uproar following further opposition heckling, with people standing on tables and chairs yelling at each other. In the subsequent discussion, four others spoke briefly, two of them opponents. Remarks from the last speaker that a dictatorship from the right would be met with a dictatorship from the left were the signal for a further uproar, such that Hitler's words closing the meeting were drowned. Around 100 independent socialists and communists poured out of the Hofbrauhaus onto the streets, cheering for the International and the Räterepublik, and booing the war heroes Hindenburg and Ludendorff and the German nationalists. The meeting had not exactly produced the hall full of people united by a new conviction, a new faith, a new will, that Hitler was later to describe. Nor would anyone reading Munich newspapers in the days following the meeting have gained the impression that it was a landmark, heralding the arrival of a new dynamic party and a new political hero. The press's reaction was muted, to say the least. The newspapers concentrated in their brief reports on Dingfelder's speech and paid little attention to Hitler. Even the Fulkesche Beobachter, not yet under party control but sympathetic, was surprisingly low-key. It reported the meeting in a single column in an inside page 4 days later. Most of the report dealt with Dingfelder's speech. Hitler's contribution was summarized in a single sentence. Herr Hitler, DAP, presented some striking political points, entwickelte einige treffende politische Bilder, which evoked spirited applause, but also roused the numerous already prejudiced opponents present to contradiction. And he gave a survey of the party's program, which in its basic features comes close to that of the Deutsche Sozialistische Partei. Despite this initial modest impact, it was already apparent that Hitler meetings meant political fireworks. Even in the hothouse of Munich politics, the big meetings of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, NSDAP, as the movement henceforth called itself, were something different. Hitler wanted above all else to make his party noticed. In this he rapidly succeeded. "It makes no difference, whatever, whether they laugh at us or revile us," he later wrote, "whether they represent us as clowns or criminals. The main thing is that they mention us, that they concern themselves with us again and again." He observed the dull, lifeless meetings of bourgeois parties, the deadening effect of speeches read out like academic lectures by dignified elderly gentlemen. Nazi meetings, he recorded with pride, were, by contrast, not peaceful. He learnt from the organization of meetings by the left how they were orchestrated, the value of intimidation of opponents, techniques of disruption, and how to deal with disturbances. The NSDAP's meetings aimed to attract confrontation, and as a result, to make the party noticed. Posters were drafted in vivid red to provoke the left to attend. In mid-1920, Hitler personally designed the party's banner with the swastika in a white circle on a red background, devised to make as striking a visual impact as possible. The result was that meetings were packed long before the start, and the numbers of opponents present guaranteed that the atmosphere was potentially explosive. To combat trouble, a hall protection squad, Saalschutz, was fully organized by mid-1920, became the gymnastic and sports section in August 1921, and eventually developed into the Storm section, Sturmabteilung or SA. Only Hitler could bring in the crowds for the NSDAP. To this extent, his self-centered account in Mein Kampf was perfectly correct. It was a month after feeling provoked into joining in the discussion of the DAP meeting on the 12th of September 1919, before his first performance as a party speaker in the Hofbraukeller on the 16th of October 1919. The memory of his success, as we have seen, lasted with him. In Mein Kampf, he used the almost identical phrase with which he had already described his self-discovery in the Lechfeld camp. "What before I had simply felt within me, without in any way knowing it, was now proved by reality. I could speak." Though plainly stylized, as the double rendition of this phrase demonstrates, there can be no doubting the self-confidence that flowed through Hitler as a result of the confirmation, for the first time before a non-captive audience, that the way he spoke could stir his audience. In the company of an individual, Hitler's egocentric manner could be totally off-putting. An acquaintance at the time, contemptuous of Hitler's activity as a Reichswehr spy, but forced to suffer an involuntary lecture on the future mission of German artists, could eventually stand no more of the peroration. "Tell me, have they shit in your brain and forgotten to flush it?" he asked, leaving Hitler speechless. But in front of a beer hall audience, Hitler's style was electrifying. While in his Nuremberg cell awaiting the hangman, Hans Frank, the ex-governor general of Poland, recalled the moment in January 1920, while he was still only 19 years old, though already committed to the Folkish cause, that he had first heard Hitler speak. The large room was bursting at the seams. Middle-class citizens rubbed shoulders with workers, soldiers, and students. Whether old or young, the state of the nation weighed heavily on people. Germany's plight polarized opinions, but left few unmoved or disinterested. Most political meetings were packed. But to Frank, young, idealistic, fervently anti-Marxist and nationalistic, speakers were generally disappointing, had little to offer. Hitler, in stark contrast, set him alight. The man with whom Hans Frank's fate would be bound for the next quarter of a century was dressed in a shabby blue suit, his tie loosely fastened. He spoke clearly, in impassioned but not shrill tones, his blue eyes flashing, occasionally pushing back his hair with his right hand. Frank's most immediate feeling was how sincere Hitler was, how the words came from the heart and were not just a rhetorical device. He was at that time simply the grandiose popular speaker without precedent, and for me, incomparable, wrote Frank. I was strongly impressed straight away. It was totally different from what was otherwise to be heard in meetings. His method was completely clear and simple. He took the overwhelmingly dominant topic of the day, the Versailles Diktat, and posed the question of all questions. What now, German people? What's the true situation? What alone is now possible? He spoke for over 2.5 hours, often interrupted by frenetic torrents of applause, and one could have listened to him for much, much longer. Everything came from the heart, and he struck a chord with all of us. He uttered what was in the consciousness of all those present, and linked general experiences to clear understanding and the common wishes of those who were suffering and hoping for a program. In the matter itself, he was certainly not original, but he was the one called to act as spokesman of the people. He concealed nothing of the horror, the distress, the despair facing Germany. But not only that. He showed a way, the only way left, to all ruined peoples in history, that of the grim new beginning from the most profound depths, through courage, faith, readiness for action, hard work, and devotion to a great, shining common goal. He placed before the protection of the Almighty, in the most serious and solemn exhortation, the salvation of the honor of the German soldier and worker as his life task. When he finished, the applause would not die down. From this evening onwards, though not a party member, I was convinced that if one man could do it, Hitler alone would be capable of mastering Germany's fate. Whatever the pathos of these comments, they testify to Hitler's instinctive ability, singling him out from other speakers relaying a similar message, to speak in the language of his listeners and to stir them through the passion and, however strange it might now sound to us, the apparent sincerity of his idealism. Rising attendances, as he noted in Mein Kampf, followed in the next weeks between his first appearance as main speaker on one of his favorite topics, Brest-Litovsk and Versailles, in the Ebelbraukeller in November 1919, and the big Hofbrauhaus meeting in February 1920. This was merely a prelude to Hitler's growing success and mounting reputation as the party's star speaker. By the end of 1920, he had addressed over 30 mass meetings, mostly of between 800 and 2,500 persons, and spoken at many smaller internal party gatherings. In early February 1921, he would speak at the biggest meeting so far, over 6,000 people in the Circus Krone, which could accommodate the biggest indoor crowds in Munich, near the Marsfeld, just to the west of the city centre. Until mid-1921, he spoke mainly in Munich, where the propaganda and organization of the meetings would ensure a satisfactory turnout, and where the right atmosphere was guaranteed. But, not counting the speeches made during a fortnight's visit to Austria in early October, he held 10 speeches outside the city in 1920, including one in Rosenheim, where the first local group of the party outside Munich had just been founded. It was largely owing to Hitler's public profile that the party membership increased sharply from 190 in January 1920 to 2,000 by the end of the year and 3,300 by August 1921. He was rapidly making himself indispensable to the movement. 4. Hitler spoke from rough notes, mainly a series of jotted headings with key words underlined. As a rule, a speech would last around 2 hours or more. In the Festsaal of the Hofbrauhaus, he used a beer table on one of the long sides of the hall as his platform in order to be in the middle of the crowd, a novel technique for a speaker, which helped create what Hitler regarded as a special mood in that hall. The themes of his speeches varied little. The contrast of Germany's strength in a glorious past with its current weakness and national humiliation, a sick state in the hands of traitors and cowards who had betrayed the fatherland to its powerful enemies, the reasons for the collapse in a lost war unleashed by these enemies, and behind them, the Jews. Betrayal and revolution brought about by criminals and Jews. English and French intentions of destroying Germany, as shown in the Treaty of Versailles, the Peace of Shame, the instrument of Germany's slavery, the exploitation of ordinary Germans by Jewish racketeers and profiteers, a cheating and corrupt government and party system presiding over economic misery, social division, political conflict, and ethical collapse. The only way to recovery contained in the points of the party's program, ruthless showdown with internal enemies and build-up of national consciousness and unity, leading to renewed strength and eventual restored greatness. The combination of traditional Bavarian dislike of the Prussians and the experience of the Räterepublik in Munich meant that Hitler's repeated onslaught on the Marxist government in Berlin was certain to meet with an enthusiastic response among the still small minority of the local population drawn to his meetings. While Hitler basically appealed to negative feelings, anger, resentment, hatred, there was also a positive element in the proposed remedy to the proclaimed ills. However platitudinous, the appeal to restoration of liberty through national unity, the need to work together, of workers of the brain and hand, zusammenarbeiten des Geistes und Handarbeiters, the social harmony of a national community and the protection of the little man through the crushing of his exploiters, were, to go from the applause they invariably produced, undeniably attractive propositions to Hitler's audiences. And Hitler's own passion and fervour successfully conveyed the message to those already predisposed to it that no other way was possible, that Germany's revival would and could be brought about, and that it lay in the power of ordinary Germans to make it happen through their own struggle, sacrifice, and will. The effect was more that of a religious revivalist meeting than a normal political gathering. What Hitler was saying had long belonged to the standard repertoire of nationalist and folkish speakers. It was as good as indistinguishable from what the pan-Germans had been preaching for years. And though Hitler was invariably up to date in finding easy targets in the daily politics of the crisis-ridden republic, his main themes were tediously repetitive. Some, in fact, often taken for granted to be part of Hitler's allegedly unchanging ideology, were missing altogether at this stage. There was, for example, not a single mention of the need for living space, Lebensraum, in Eastern Europe. Britain and France were the foreign policy targets at this time. Indeed, Hitler jotted among the notes of one of his speeches in August 1920, "Brotherhood towards the East, Verbrüderung nach Osten." Nor did he clamour for a dictatorship. Such a demand occurs in only one speech in 1920 on the 27th of April, in which Hitler declared that Germany needed a dictator who is a genius if it were to rise up again. There is no implication that he himself was that person. Surprisingly, too, his first outright public assault on Marxism did not occur before his speech at Rosenheim on the 21st of July 1920, though he had spoken on a number of occasions before this of the catastrophic effects of Bolshevism in Russia, for which he blamed the Jews. And, remarkably, even race theory, where Hitler drew heavily for his ideas from well-known anti-Semitic tracts such as those of Houston Stuart Chamberlain, Adolf Warmont, and especially the arch-populariser Theodor Fritsch, one of whose emphases was the alleged sexual abuse of women by Jews, was explicitly treated in only one speech by Hitler during 1920. This scarcely meant, however, that Hitler neglected to attack the Jews. On the contrary, the all-devouring manic obsession with the Jews, to which all else is subordinated, not observable before 1919, never absent thereafter, courses through almost every Hitler speech at this time. Behind all evil that had befallen or was threatening Germany stood the figure of the Jew. In speech after speech he lashed the Jews in the most vicious and barbaric language imaginable. Genuine socialism, declared Hitler, meant to be an anti-Semite. Germans should be ready to enter into a pact with the devil to eradicate the evil of Jewry. But, as in his letter to Gemlich the previous autumn, he did not see emotional anti-Semitism as the answer. He demanded internment in concentration camps to prevent Jewish undermining of our people, hanging for racketeers, but ultimately, as the only solution, similar to the Gimlich letter, the removal of the Jews from our people. The implication, as in his explicit demands with regard to Ostjuden, was their expulsion from Germany. This was undoubtedly how it was understood. But, as with some pre-war anti-Semites, the language itself was both terrible and implicitly genocidal in its biological similes. You don't talk about what to do with parasites, trichinen, and bacilli. Parasites and bacilli are also not reared. They are as quickly and fully as possible destroyed, vernichtet. This was not Hitler, it was Paul de la Garde, leading Oriental scholar and specialist in Semitic languages, in 1887, writing of how, in his view, Jews should be treated. The atmosphere had become immeasurably more menacing towards the Jews when Hitler deployed similar terminology over 30 years later. "Don't think that you can combat racial tuberculosis," he declared in August 1920, "without seeing to it that the people is freed from the causative organ of racial tuberculosis. The impact of Jewry will never pass away, and the poisoning of the people will not end as long as the causal agent, the Jew, is not removed from our midst." His audiences loved it. More than anything else, these attacks evoke torrents of applause and cheering. His technique, beginning slowly, plenty of sarcasm, personalized attacks on named targets, then a gradual crescendo to a climax, whipped his audiences into a frenzy. His speech in the Festsaal of the Hofbrauhaus on the 13th of August 1920 on "Why Are We Anti-Semites?", his only speech that year solely relating to the Jews and probably intended as a basic statement on the topic, was interrupted 58 times during its 2 hours' duration by ever wilder cheering from the 2,000-strong audience. To go from a report on another Hitler speech a few weeks later, the audience would have been mainly drawn from white-collar workers, the lower middle class, and better-off workers, with around a quarter women. At first, Hitler's anti-Semitic tirades were invariably linked to anti-capitalism and attacks on Jewish war profiteers and racketeers, whom he blamed for exploiting the German people and causing the loss of the war and the German war dead. He later claimed, in a horrific passage of Mein Kampf, that 1 million German lives lost at the front would have been saved if 12,000 to 15,000 of these Hebrew corruptors of the people had been held under poison gas. The influence of Gottfried Feder can be seen in the distinction Hitler drew between essentially healthy industrial capital and the real evil of Jewish finance capital. There was no link with Marxism or Bolshevism at this stage. Contrary to what is sometimes claimed, Hitler's anti-Semitism was not prompted by his anti-Bolshevism, it long predated it. There was no mention of Bolshevism in the Gemlich letter of September 1919, where the Jewish question is related to the rapacious nature of finance capital. Hitler spoke in April and again in June 1920 of Russia being destroyed by the Jews, but it was only in his Rosenheim speech on the 21st of July that he explicitly married the images of Marxism, Bolshevism, and the Soviet system in Russia to the brutality of Jewish rule, for which he saw social democracy preparing the ground in Germany. Hitler admitted in August 1920 that he knew little of the real situation in Russia, but, perhaps influenced above all by Alfred Rosenberg, who came from the Baltic and experienced the Russian Revolution at first hand, but probably also soaking up images of the horror of the Russian Civil War which were filtering through to the German press, he plainly became preoccupied with Bolshevik Russia in the second half of the year. The dissemination of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the forgery about Jewish world domination, widely read and believed in anti-Semitic circles at the time, probably also helped to focus Hitler's attention on Russia. These images appear to have provided the catalyst to the merger of anti-Semitism and anti-Marxism in his worldview, an identity which, once forged, never disappeared. 5. Hitler's speeches put him on the political map in Munich, but he was still very much a local taste, and however much noise he made, his party was still insignificant compared with the established socialist and Catholic parties. Moreover, though it is going too far to see him as no more than the tool of powerful vested interests behind the scenes, without influential backers and the connections they could provide, his talents as a mob agitator would not have got him very far. Though Hitler had already signalled his intention of making a living as a political speaker, he was, in fact, until the 31st of March 1920, still drawing pay from the army. His first patron, Captain Mayer, continued to take a close interest in him, and, if his later account can be believed, provided limited funding towards the staging of the mass meetings. At this time, Hitler was still serving both the party and the army. In January and February 1920, Mayer had Herr Hitler lecturing on Versailles and political parties and their significance in the company of distinguished Munich historians Karl Alexander von Müller and Paul Joachimsen to Reichswehr soldiers undertaking citizenship education courses. In March, during the Kapp Putsch, when a short-lived armed coup had attempted to overthrow the government, forcing it to flee from the Reich capital, he sent him with Dietrich Eckart to Berlin to instruct Wolfgang Kapp on the situation in Bavaria. They arrived too late. The Reich's first attempt to take over the state had already collapsed. But Mayer was undeterred. He retained both his contact with Kapp and his interest in Hitler. He still had hopes, so he told Kapp 6 months later, that the NSDAP, which he thought of as his own creation, would become the organization of national radicalism, the advance guard of a future, more successful putsch. He wrote to Kapp, now exiled in Sweden, "The National Workers' Party must provide the basis for the strong assault force, Stoßtrupp, that we are hoping for. The program is still somewhat clumsy and also perhaps incomplete. We'll have to supplement it. Only one thing is certain, that under this banner we've already won a good number of supporters. Since July of last year, I've been looking to strengthen the movement. I've set up very capable young people. A Herr Hitler, for example, has become a motive force, a popular speaker, Volksredner, of the first rank. In the Munich branch, we have over 2,000 members, compared with under 100 in summer 1919. Early in 1920, before Hitler had left the Reichswehr, Mayer had taken him along to meetings of the Iron Fist Club for radical nationalist officers, founded by Captain Ernst Röhm. Hitler had been introduced to Röhm by Mayer, probably the previous autumn. Interested in a variety of nationalist parties, particularly with a view to winning the workers to the nationalist cause, Röhm had attended the first meeting of the DAP, addressed by Hitler on the 16th of October 1919, and had joined the party shortly afterwards. Now Hitler came into far closer contact with Röhm, who rapidly came to replace Mayer as the key link with the Reichswehr. Röhm had been responsible for arming the volunteers and civil defense Einwohnerwehr units in Bavaria, and had in the meantime become an important player in paramilitary politics, with excellent connections in the army, the patriotic associations, and throughout the Folkish Right. He was, in fact, at this time, along with his fellow officers on the right, far more interested in the massive Einwohnerwehren, with a membership of over 250,000 men, than he was in the tiny NSDAP. Even so, he provided the key contact between the NSDAP and the far larger patriotic associations, and offered avenues to funding which the constantly hard-up party desperately needed. His connections proved invaluable, increasingly so from 1921 onwards, when his interest in Hitler's party grew. Another important patron at this time was the Folkish poet and publicist Dietrich Eckart. More than 20 years older than Hitler, Eckart, who had initially made his name with a translation of Peer Gynt, had not been notably successful before the war as a poet and critic. Possibly this stimulated his intense anti-Semitism. He became politically active in December 1918 with the publication of his anti-Semitic weekly Auf gut Deutsch in plain German, which also featured contributions from Gottfried Feder and the young émigré from the Baltic, Alfred Rosenberg. He spoke at DAP meetings in the summer of 1919 before Hitler joined, and evidently came to regard the party's new recruit as his own protégé. Hitler himself was flattered by the attention paid to him by a figure of Eckart's reputation in Folkish circles. In the early years, relations between the two were good, even close. But for Hitler, as ever, it was Eckart's usefulness that counted. As Hitler's self-importance grew, his need for Eckart declined, and by 1923, the year of Eckart's death, the two had become estranged. At first, however, there could be no doubt of Eckart's value to Hitler and the NSDAP. Through his well-heeled connections, Eckart offered the beer hall demagogue an entry into Munich society, opening for him the door to the salons of wealthy and influential members of the city's bourgeoisie, and through his financial support and that of his contacts, he was able to offer vital assistance to the financially struggling small party. Since membership fees did not remotely cover outgoings, the party was dependent upon help from outside. It came in part from the owners of Munich firms and businesses, including the publisher Lehmann. Some aid continued to come from the Reichswehr. Mayor's office paid for the 3,000 brochures attacking the detested Versailles Treaty, seen not just on the extreme right as cripplingly punitive and humiliating for Germany, which Lehmann had published for the party in June 1920. But Eckart's role was crucial. He arranged, for example, the funding from his friend, the Augsburg chemist and factory owner Dr. Gottfried Grundl, who also backed the periodical Auf gut Deutsch, for the plane that took him and Hitler to Berlin at the time of the Kapp Putsch. Grundl later served as a guarantor for the funds used to purchase the Völkischer Beobachter and turn it into the party's own newspaper in December 1920. The party leadership had been looking to buy the near-bankrupt Beobachter since the summer to provide the wider publicity that was needed. But it was only in mid-December, when rival bidders for the newspaper emerged, that Hitler moved. Together with Hermann Esser and the deputy party chairman Oskar Körner, he turned up in an agitated state at Drexler's flat at 2 o'clock in the morning on the 17th of December, claiming the Beobachter was in danger, that it was about to fall into Bavarian separatists' hands. Drexler's mother was wakened up to make coffee, and around the kitchen table it was decided that Drexler would first thing the next morning call on Eckart to persuade him to encourage his wealthy contacts to provide the financial backing to acquire the newspaper. Hitler, meanwhile, would seek out Dr. Grundl in Augsburg. 6 hours later, Drexler was drumming an irritable Eckart out of bed, disgruntled at being awakened so early. They were soon on their way to see General von Epp. Eckart convinced the latter how vital it was to gain possession of the Beobachter, and stood guarantor with his house and property for the 60,000 marks which Epp provided from the funds of the Reichswehr. Other sources yielded a further 30,000 marks, and Drexler himself, earning 35 marks a week, took over the remaining debts of 113,000 marks before, that afternoon, becoming the legal owner of the Völkischer Beobachter. Thanks to Eckart, the Reichswehr, and in no small measure to Drexler himself, Hitler now had his newspaper. His thanks to Eckart were suitably fulsome. 6. To the Munich public, by 1921, Hitler was the NSDAP. He was its voice, its representative figure, its embodiment. Asked to name the party's chairman, perhaps even politically informed citizens might have guessed wrongly. But Hitler did not want the chairmanship. Drexler offered it him on a number of occasions, but Hitler refused. Drexler wrote to Feder in spring 1921, stating that each revolutionary movement must have a dictatorial head, and therefore I also think our Hitler is the most suitable for our movement without wanting to be pushed into the background myself. But for Hitler, the party chairmanship meant organizational responsibility. He had, this was to remain the case during the rise to power and when he headed the German state, neither aptitude nor ability for organizational matters. Organization he could leave to others. Propaganda, mobilization of the masses, was what he was good at and what he wanted to do. For that, and that alone, he would take responsibility. Propaganda for Hitler was the highest form of political activity. He had learnt at first from the Social Democrats, as well as from the anti-Semites of the Schutz und Trutzbund. He probably also learnt from Gustave Le Bon's tract on crowd psychology, though most likely at second hand. But most of all, he learnt from his own experience of the power of the spoken word, given the right political climate, the right crisis atmosphere, and a public ready to trust in political faith more than reasoned argument. In Hitler's own conception, propaganda was the key to the nationalization of the masses, without which there could be no national salvation. It was not that propaganda and ideology, Weltanschauung, were distinctive entities for him. They were inseparable and reinforced each other. An idea for Hitler was useless unless it mobilized. The self-confidence he gained from the rapturous reception of his speeches assured him that his diagnosis of Germany's ills and the way to national redemption was right, the only one possible. This in turn gave him the self-conviction that conveyed itself to those in his immediate entourage, as well as those listening to his speeches in the beer halls. To see himself as drummer of the national cause was therefore for Hitler a high calling. It was why, before the middle of 1921, he preferred to be free for this role and not to be bogged down in the organizational work which he associated with the chairmanship of the party. The outrage felt throughout Germany at the punitive sum of 226,000 million gold marks to be paid in reparations imposed by the Paris Conference at the end of January 1921 ensured there would be no let-up in agitation. This was the background for the biggest meeting that the NSDAP had until then staged, on the 3rd of February in the Circus Krone. Hitler risked going ahead with the meeting at only one day's notice and without the usual advance publicity. In a rush, the huge hall was booked and two lorries hired to drive round the city throwing out leaflets. This was another technique borrowed from the Marxists and the first time the Nazis had used it. Despite worries until the last minute that the hall would be half empty and the meeting would prove a propaganda debacle, more than 6,000 turned up to hear Hitler speaking on future or ruin, Zukunft oder Untergang, denounce the slavery imposed on Germany by the Allied reparations, and castigate the weakness of the government for accepting them. The known leader of the anti-Semites, Hitler, had less success 3 days later, when, as third speaker at a mass rally of 20,000 members of the patriotic associations in Odeonsplatz, he made no impact with his party political tendencies. Hitler wrote that after the Circus Krone success, he increased the NSDAP's propaganda activity in Munich still further. And indeed, the propaganda output was impressive. Hitler spoke at 28 major meetings in Munich and 12 elsewhere, nearly all still in Bavaria, apart from several contributions to discussions and 7 addresses to the newly formed SA in the latter part of the year. Between January and June 1921, he also wrote 39 articles for the Völkische Beobachter, and from September onwards contributed a number of pieces to the party's internal information leaflets, Mitteilungsblätter. Of course, he had the time in which to devote himself solely to propaganda. Unlike the other members of the party leadership, he had no other occupation or interest. Politics consumed practically his entire existence. When he was not giving speeches or preparing them, he spent time reading. As always, much of this was the newspapers, giving him regular ammunition for his scourge of Weimar politicians. He had books, a lot of them popular editions, on history, geography, Germanic myths, and especially war, including Clausewitz, on the shelves of his shabby, sparsely furnished room at 41 Tierstrasse, down by the Isar. But what exactly he read is impossible to know. His lifestyle scarcely lent itself to lengthy periods of systematic reading. He claimed, however, to have read up on his hero, Frederick the Great, and pounced on the work of his rival in the Völkisch camp, Otto Dickel, a 320-page treatise on Die Auferstehung des Abendlandes, The Resurrection of the Western World, a mystical tract attempting to turn Spengler's pessimism on its head immediately on its appearance in 1921 in order to be able to castigate it. Otherwise, as it had been since the Vienna days, much of his time was spent lounging around cafes in Munich. According to his photographer Heinrich Hoffmann, he specially liked the Café Heck in Galerienstrasse, his favorite. In a quiet corner of the long, narrow room of this coffee house, frequented by Munich's solid middle class, he could sit at his reserved table, his back to the wall, holding court among the newfound cronies that he had attracted to the NSDAP. Among those coming to form an inner circle of Hitler's associates were the young student Rudolf Hess, the Baltic Germans Alfred Rosenberg, who had worked on Eckart's periodical since 1919, and Max Erwin von Scheubner-Richter, an engineer with excellent contacts to wealthy Russian émigrés. Certainly by the time Putzi Hanfstengel, the cultured half-American who became his foreign press chief, came to know him late in 1922, Hitler had a table booked every Monday evening at the old-fashioned Café Neumeier on the edge of the Viktualienmarkt. His regular accompaniment formed a motley crew, mostly lower middle class, some unsavory characters among them. Christian Weber, former pub bouncer and horse dealer, who, like Hitler, invariably carried a dog whip and relished the brawls with communists, was one. Another was Hermann Esser, formerly Mayer's press agent, himself an excellent agitator, and an even better gutter journalist. Max Amann, another roughneck, Hitler's former sergeant who became overlord of the Nazi press empire, was also usually there, as were Ulrich Graf, Hitler's personal bodyguard, and, frequently, the philosophers of the party, Gottfried Feder and Dietrich Eckart. In the long room with its rows of benches and tables, often occupied by elderly couples, Hitler's entourage would discuss politics or listen to his monologues on art and architecture while eating the snacks they had brought with them and drinking their liters of beer or cups of coffee. At the end of the evening, Weber, Amann, Graf, and Lieutenant Klinch, a veteran of the Erhard Brigade who had taken part in the Kapp-Putsch, would act as a bodyguard, escorting Hitler, wearing the long black overcoat and trilby that gave him the appearance of a conspirator, back to his apartment in Tierstrasse. Hitler scarcely cut the figure of a mainstream politician. Not surprisingly, the Bavarian establishment regarded him largely with contempt, but they could not ignore him. The old-fashioned monarchist head of the Bavarian government at the time, Minister-President Gustav Ritter von Kahr, who had assumed office on the 16th of March 1920, following the Kapp-Putsch, and aimed to turn Bavaria into a cell of order representing true national values, thought Hitler was a propagandist and nothing more. This was a not unjustifiable assessment at the time. But Kahr was keen to gather national forces in Bavaria in protest at the fulfillment policy of Reich Chancellor Wirth. And he felt certain that he could make use of Hitler, that he could control the impetuous Austrian. On the 14th of May 1921, he invited a delegation from the NSDAP, led by Hitler, to discuss the political situation with him. It was the first meeting of the two men whose identical aim of destroying the new Weimar democracy was to link them, if fleetingly, in the ill-fated putsch of November 1923, a checkered association that would end with Kahr's murder in the Night of the Long Knives at the end of June 1934. Whatever Kahr's disdain for Hitler, his invitation to a meeting in May 1921 amounted to recognition that the latter was now a factor in Bavarian politics, proof that he and his movement had to be taken seriously. Rudolf Hess, still studying at Munich under the geopolitician Professor Karl Haushofer, introverted and idealistic, and already besotted with Hitler, was part of the delegation. 3 days later, unsolicited and unprompted by Hitler, he wrote a lengthy letter to Kahr describing Hitler's early life and eulogizing about his political aims, ideals, and skills. Hitler, he wrote, was an unusually decent, sincere character, full of kind-heartedness, religious, a good Catholic, with only one aim, the welfare of his country. Hess went on to laud Hitler's self-sacrifice in this cause, how he received not a penny from the movement itself, but made his living purely from the fees he received for other speeches he occasionally made. This was the official line that Hitler himself had put out the previous September in the Völkische Beobachter. It was quite disingenuous. On no more than a handful of occasions did he speak at nationalist meetings other than those of the NSDAP. The fees from these alone would certainly not have been enough to keep body and soul together. Rumours about his income and lifestyle were avidly taken up on the left. Even on the folkish right, there were remarks about him being chauffeured around Munich in a big car, and his enemies in the party raised questions about his personal financial irregularities and the amount of time the King of Munich spent in an